Hello and welcome back to the Slightly Fox podcast. December now, and we thought this was the perfect time to bring you a seasonal episode. We're going to attempt an exploration of winter writing over 12 centuries, and all in just 30 minutes. Author and academic Alexandra Harris will be our guide. Hold on to your hats. Now, as usual nowadays, we're scattered around the country. I'm Philippa Lamb. I'm in Cambridge. Hazel Wood joins us from Highbury. Hi, Hazel.
Hello.
Have you got the rain there? It's absolutely pouring everywhere.
Well, winter has really closed in, yes.
And Gail, down in the West Country, what's happening on Dartmoor?
Well, we're storm-lashed at the moment, so I'm hoping that my internet connection survives. But we're cosy, and the dogs love the cold weather, so they're very happy.
Fellow Fox Anna Kirk is with us too. And you're at Fox HQ, aren't you, Anna, in Hoxton Square? Is it just you?
No, it's me and Hattie in today. And here as well, it's absolutely pouring. But one benefit to this weather means the builders are not currently just outside. But if the rain clears up, then they may well be back.
The builders. We haven't had the builders on the podcast for months. I hear on the grapevine you got absolutely drenched on the way in.
Yes, I was being sensible for once and actually had a huge umbrella with me and was wearing a raincoat. But about 20 minutes into my walk this morning, a London bus came directly at me and completely drenched from top to toe. And then I just stood in the pavement for a moment just with a shocked look on my face.
Oh, the bus and the puddle. It's the worst, isn't it?
Yes. So unfortunately, my shoes and socks are on radiators in the office here, but I'm warming up and drying off.
Glad to hear it, Anna, because I know you're very busy right now.
Yes, it's all systems go. Trying to clamber over post bags. There's lots of writing of lovely gift cards and all of that. So yes, we will be posting right up until the last moment, but we're trying to get everything wrapped up and ribboned and into the post in good time.
So this is you politely saying, if you'd like to order, please order now.
Yes, just to help us out a bit. That would be great.
Now, I know you took a little moment, didn't you, to go off on a literary expedition, which has got Christmassy associations for all you foxes.
Yes, I made a little expedition to the London Library. We had our 60th issue / Christmas party there a couple of years ago. It's a fantastic place to go to read and write. We had a Slightly Fox membership to the London Library, so we used it as a resource to seek out potential Slightly Foxed editions. So the London Library has been in St James's Square since 1845. The idea came from Thomas Carlyle, who craved a lending library in London. He gathered founding subscribers like Charles Dickens, John Stuart Mill, Alfred Lord Tennyson and T.S. Eliot have been president of the library, so it really is a very historic place. The book stacks alone cover 7 floors, and there's 17 miles of shelving, so you can really get lost within there, and all sorts of different things. Like, their science and miscellaneous collections are extraordinary. Things like dreams, wine, sewage, anything that you might like to look up makes for quite an eclectic browsing. And it still really retains that kind of Victorian feel. Of course, they have, you know, a busy schedule of events, an emerging writers programme, and they also provide free guided tours to non-members. Well, they usually do.
So you can do, they can do a guided tour for you, even if you don't belong.
Yes, exactly. So they'll take you around.
No, and the marvellous thing for a researcher, of course, at the London Library is that you can actually go into the stacks. That's quite rare, I think, at the British Library. You know, you have to order your books.
Well, also, you can borrow books and take them out, and then you can post them back to them.
Yes, and you can take out quite a lot of books at the same time, so it's a marvellous place.
And they do deliver books to members who can't pick them up in person as well.
Yeah.
Well, this is great. Thanks, Anna. I mean, if anyone does go and visit the library, let us know. We'd love to hear what you thought of it, and I'm definitely going to go myself next year. Time now, though, to welcome our final guest of 2020, Alexandra Harris, Professorial Fellow in English at the University of Birmingham and author of prize-winning books including Romantic Moderns, Virginia Woolf and Weatherland. Hello, Alex.
Hello, very happy to be here.
Where are you?
Oh, I am in Oxford. I'm in my little Victorian terraced house in Oxford, looking out on continuous rain, what might have been, I think, called in the 18th century, they would have said it was a lowering kind of day.
Well, see, this is ideal because we're going to be talking about wintry writing and the weather is definitely in tune with our theme today.
It is.
You have a special love, don't you, of wintry writing?
Yes, I do. I wonder quite when it started. I'm sure I wasn't in love with winter when I was 10. I think one of the first poems that really did it for me was John Donne talking about the year's midnight in his Nocturnal on St. Lucy's Day. It's about that still point of the year when the world's whole sap is sunk, and it's about that relationship between deadness and light that suddenly sparks up through it. I was completely gripped by this whole idea of endings pivoting into beginnings and something to do with this relationship between wildness outside and absolute concentration that's possible inside. And I think through history, writers have been very, very drawn to that frisson.
And that sense of fending off peril outside.
Yes.
That's very wintry, isn't it?
Yes. But I think now we can almost fend off peril so easily. We're so used to our central heating that we've lost some of the drama of that relationship.
I'm very intrigued by your book, Weatherland. I've been reading it. It's a really interesting premise because it's about how writers and artists over the centuries have looked up at the same English skies, but they have written very different things. And I think in it, you're associating different periods in English writing and English history with different seasons. So it's a fascinating concept, and we're going to attempt to thread our way through that. And I think one of the threads running through the book is Virginia Woolf, isn't it? Her book, Orlando.
Yes. Everything I've ever written is in some way trying to work through an idea of Virginia Woolf's. Her 1928 book, Orlando, is not only the experimental biography of a man who turns into a woman and lives 400 years, but also a great question about how we write history, which means asking what matters to people, what influences the way they act. And one of her ways of prodding at societies and seeing how they change is to suggest that they have different weathers in each period. And it's all a great big joke, and you read Orlando and it flashes and dashes and leaps ahead, and you just admire the brilliant cool wit of it. And then after a while you think, wait, where did she get this idea from? That somehow Elizabethan summers are blazingly hot, that Victorian winters are dank, and the water butt is forever dripping into the conservatory. Yeah. Where does all this come from? And I mean, I think all academics are rightfully very wary of caricatures and stereotypes.
But there's an atmosphere, isn't there, to different
eras? Exactly.
Eras.
This yeah. is it. And so I began to sort of try and unpick this. And I did start to understand that writers experiencing roughly the same weather, and we can talk more about this, and clearly there have been climatic shifts, but there was snow in 1200. There was also snow in 1700. It's just that people write about it in different ways.
Should we backtrack right to the very beginning? Should we go right back to the, 8th century, 9th century and talk about the Wanderer?
Oh, OK, we might get stuck here. That we've got to move me on eventually because I love the Anglo-Saxon period so much. What I realised quite early on is that people who were writing and making oral poetry were very mesmerised by visions of winter, by bleakness, which is somehow the real thing. It's as if spring and summer are decoration on the world. Writers often use little phrases to suggest that spring comes to clothe the earth, as if the real naked truth of things is winter, and that's what you have to contend with. They have all sorts of good words for, like, winter kiarig means, like, winter care. We don't have a word for that now.
And where does The Wanderer fit into this? Is this not a book I knew anything about, Alex? Tell us a bit about it.
Ah, okay. So The Wanderer is one of a series of elegies in the Exeter book, which is a sort of anthology. The book itself dates from the 10th century, but The Wanderer was probably earlier. And it takes the form of our being introduced to an exile who we hear has left his culture, his home, and is ploughing the icy waves. We have the sense that it's both real and clearly metaphorical as well, that having been cast out, he feels cold. And loneliness, I think, does feel cold. And we still use all these idioms of feeling cold-hearted or shut out by a cold gesture. All of those are present already in The Wanderer. I can give you a tiny glimpse of it if you'd like.
Yeah, give us a taster, Alex.
I'm hoping you don't mind having the translation. I left that place in wretchedness, ploughed the icy waves with winter in my heart. In sadness, I sought far and wide for a treasure giver, for a man who would welcome me into his mead hall, give me good cheer, for I boasted no friends, entertain me with delights. And then our exile dreams of the mead hall of clasps and kisses. But he wakes and sees the dark waves surging around him, the seabirds bathing, spreading their feathers, frost and snow falling mingled with hail.
Good. Oh, chilly, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Isn't it? But isn't it contemporary? Mm. It makes me realise that that's a timeless poem of a migrant. That is a poem about exile. Also, look at the way that that poet just binds together in the structure of this poem, that vision of a mead hall, of a lord there to pour the mead into your glistening gold cup, and then that waking from the dream, it's cold. And I like the fact that it's not only ice, it's snow and hail falling mingled with ice.
I was interested to read in your book, actually, this point about writing in the Middle Ages, when they talked about warmth, they didn't talk about sunshine, they talked about fire. Because, as you say, the whole perception was that really it's winter all the time.
Mm. It's really hard to give one reason why this is. It might be to do with the fact that most of these stories are designed to be told in the hall during winter. And also perhaps the fact that part of art's power is to try and keep out the elements or to suggest how we can control them. It's when things get grim that we need stories, that we need poetry to help us face them. In the Christian tradition, there's also this sense that to be on earth, to be a mortal person, is to be contending with weather. I mean, Eden was fine. We don't have any bother with weather in Eden. But it's all after our sin. The fall into time, into the temporal world, is the fall into weather. And there's Beowulf. I mean, I know Beowulf has a terrible reputation as the apogee of the set text, but there are terrific translations around, notably Seamus Heaney's.
And his reading.
Absolutely right. And if you read it with a contemporary mind, I think you probably come to it with different ideas. Contemporary nature writing has shown us so much about how to read weathers and places. And you go back to Beowulf and you find misty moors, a monster, Grendel, coming over the cliffs as a shadow stalker, coming down through bands of mist. I mean, yes, there's a kind of gothic to it, but there's also, I think, again, something that feels very modern about a kind of eeriness in our outdoor world.
I can hear your passion for the Anglo-Saxon time, Alex, and I'm going to drag you forward.
This is going to sound cartoon-like, but I actually think that spring comes to English literature in about the 13th century. There's a real re-greening, what they called a reverdi, re-greening songs, celebrating spring, and a sense that poetry belongs not so much now to winter, but to spring, that love belongs to spring. And lots of this is coming up from Europe, is coming from the troubadour cultures in France. You know, our weather writing is such a melting pot of influences from all over the place. And lots of these meet in the Middle Ages, which is a terrifically international time. But I got really interested in the relationship between a sort of version of the year which ticks along in the sense that all the seasons are doing what they're meant to do. And medieval people are very, very interested in the cycle of the year. We see it in the poem Gawain and the Green Knight, for example. And the medieval writers are looking at places where actually perhaps nature doesn't behave as it's meant to, it's out of control. And this human condition in which you have to grapple with what's wrong with the weather, but also a sense that it must be the right weather because it's God's weather.
I'm going to haul you on the Renaissance.
Ah, well, we started by talking about Virginia Woolf's sense that weather in the Renaissance was very definite and dramatic, that dawns were auroral and the fires were blazing. I think there's something in this. It's to do, I think, with a need to be able to read the weather in terms of its metaphysical meaning. The weather is God's sign language. And it's quite difficult to interpret what mizzle might mean, or a sort of blowy, slightly damp day. But if you've got a thunderstorm, if a lightning bolt lands on the house of a Catholic recusant, you're going to interpret that in particular ways. And so what we find in the 16th and 17th centuries is a whole world of literature trying to work out the symbolism of weather and how to personify it. And the Armada, the time of the Armada, for example, the whole politics of the battle with Spain started to be read in terms of whose ships were being more blown by the wind. And at the point where Britain's ships get scattered, you know, it must be a Catholic wind, but then the Spanish fleet is wrecked by a sudden gale, which of course is celebrated in Britain as a Protestant wind. And yet, of course, at the same time, writers are making it intimate too. They're thinking about the weathers of the body. The body itself, before the Enlightenment, is a mixture of weathers because of the sense that the four humours are all boiling over, that the outdoor weather affects the balance of the humours, and that each of the humours is related to one of the seasons. So to be phlegmatic, for example, is to be related to winter. There's this really wonderful, complex clockwork system of interrelationships that to a poet like Donne is just magic, because when he wants to suggest to us winter as the still point of the world, he can draw on that idea of the phlegmatic, of the sap sinking to the bottom of the bed. He can make all of that universal thinking about humours and weathers into something utterly sexual and sensual and intimate, like your bedpost and how you might want to just be asleep in winter, or perhaps be in bed with a lover. And all of this is going on in the greatest writers of the Renaissance and then the Jacobean period.
Well, yeah, not least Shakespeare, of course, had a lot of fun with winter weather.
Oh, yes. Now, the brilliant thing about Shakespeare is, of course, that he absolutely refuses summings up. You know, I'm not going to say that he associates himself with a particular kind of winter. Even look, The Winter's Tale, you think, oh, that must be a good winter play. But most of it's about spring. He welds a kind of spring comedy onto a winter tragedy. And look, at the point of that welding, he gives us one of those classic winter still points. And I think this is what makes The Winter's Tale truly a winter's tale. Shakespeare does so many extraordinary things with the mess of the seasons. He uses the very firm structure of the four-part seasons and just blows it apart, so that you pick up A Midsummer Night's Dream and you think it's a summer play, but actually, look, winter's come. It's flooded. Part of what's so gripping there is that Shakespeare's gesturing to this very orderly calendrical cycle of feast days, like Twelfth Night, for example, when you might want a play performed, when you'd all be gathered in your Renaissance equivalent of the Mead Hall. But he's always bringing in to the archetypes of different weathers something that just makes them new for us.
And this was the time of the great freezes, wasn't it? For people who don't know about the great freezes, tell us.
Oh, now this is a lost thing in our culture, the frost fair. There were many centuries where the Thames would freeze over. It doesn't do so now because of the embanking of it. But the 17th century saw some terrific frost fairs when there would be stalls set up on the frozen ice. It was frozen so hard that you could light big fires on it and roast boars and all sorts of spectacular festive things.
And it was frozen for months at a time, wasn't it?
Yes, 1683-4. It lasted for 2 or 3 months. And then think of the drama after all that time of the thaw. And Virginia Woolf makes the best of that thaw in Orlando, I tell you. Writers are very drawn to this kind of alternative world of the frozen frost fair carnival, which is bacchanalian. And yet also this is a time of blowing your nails, of penury, of suffering, of death. And yet in the midst of it, as humans so often do, you somehow make a celebration. Worf, I know, when she was making her big Frost Fair scene in Orlando, was reading back to lots of Renaissance recorders of these Frost Fairs. So Thomas Dekker is a writer I'd really recommend. You can get hold of his Cold Doings, should you want a real catalogue of the Cold Doings in 17th century London.
Yes, Pepys wrote about it in his diaries, didn't he?
Yes. Pepys went along to the Frost Fair in 1683. Oh, a very violent frost began, he says, which lasted to the 6th of February in so great extremity that the pools were frozen 18 inches thick at least, and the Thames was so frozen that a great street from the Temple to Southwark was built with shops and all manner of things sold.
It's a fabulous image, the idea of a great street of ice right through the heart of London. And think what it must have been like when it started to thaw.
The thaw was a really dramatic moment. Talk about the carpet being pulled from under your feet. These traders who had set up really elaborately, printers and all manner of taverns. There are still some magic objects that survive from it. There's a piece of gingerbread inscribed with the date of that frost fair. John Evelyn, the diarist Evelyn, has a sort of contrasting idea from Pepys. He's rather worried by the bacchanalian excess of it all. I went across the Thames, he says, upon the ice, which was now become so incredibly thick as to bear not only whole streets of booths in which they roasted meat and had diverse shops of wares, quite across as in a town, but coaches and carts and horses passed over. And he thought that this was perhaps getting us all into sinful trouble and that we were going to bring on the sort of final apocalyptic freeze.
So moving on, would it be fair to say that in the 18th century things took a rather damper turn?
Well, what I think happens is that people are more interested in recording daily weather. There's a bit of a shift from being absolutely possessed by these signs and blazing symbols of meteors in the God-given sky to a kind of writing, a kind of diary keeping. This is a whole new thing, diary keeping, that just looks out of the window and says, oh, what's going on here? And of course, what's going on is often extremely undramatic. And I think that a really key writer here, who's hardly read today at all, is James Thompson, who published a season cycle in the 1720s. He started with winter, I think that's 1724, and by 1730 he'd finished all four seasons. All through the Victorian period, this was learned by every child at school. People would recite it. It influenced so many later writers. Austen had him by heart. But Thompson did something really distinct, which was to find language for breezes, for just little changes of the light. He's very good on verbs, of seasons trembling into being, of fogs spreading and growing. It's all verbs, it's all motion, the weather changing all the time. And I think this gets deep into the sensibility of the 18th century. And one of my great discoveries writing this book was the poet William Cowper. He's the other end of the century, writing his most famous poem, The Task, in 1785. And much of this poem is set in winter, and he's willing to celebrate winter again, but in a way that's really different from the Anglo-Saxons, and is all about a kind of dailiness. It's not about heroism at all and fighting monsters out in the Danish snow. It's concerned with the poet just in his little house in Buckinghamshire. He lived in Olney. He wanted to get the daily routine that allowed him to work. And he felt safe in winter. He loved the way that you could shut out the world on a winter night and wheel your sofa round to the fire and concentrate. This was his time of readily concentration. And the post comes, bringing the newspapers, bringing news of the world to his rural retreat. Cowper was a very, very politically engaged writer, but also a very domestic writer. And I think those two things in combination are really important, because it's very easy for us to, you know, have this very cosy idea of winter and the fireside, and we all love that. But Cooper's concerned, I think, with how we reach out from our private firesides. He was an abolitionist, he was fighting for animal rights, he had all kinds of engagements with the world beyond him. So to think of winter as the time of privacy and concentration and trying to connect with each other.
Have you got an extract for us, Alex?
Ah, yes. Now stir the fire and close the shutters fast. Let fall the curtains, wheel the sofa round, and while the bubbling and loud hissing urn throws up a steamy column, and the cups that cheer but not inebriate wait on each, so let us welcome peaceful evening in. Then he says, O winter, ruler of the inverted year, thy scattered hair with sleet like ashes filled, thy breath congealed upon thy lips, thy cheeks fringed with a beard made white with other snows than those of age, thy forehead wrapped in clouds, a leafless branch thy sceptre, and thy throne a sliding car indebted to no wheels, but urged by storms along its slippery way, I love thee, all unlovely as thou seem'st, and dreaded as thou art. I just wanted to show you that taking the old archetype of winter and turning it on its head to say, I love you.
Yeah, huge contrast to everything we've
talked
about.
Exactly, yeah, exactly, exactly. And The Task is such a conversational poem. He wanted to write an epic of the sofa.
So as we tip over into the early 19th century, obviously we encounter a lot of writers that are perhaps more familiar to many of us. Was there a change of pace then?
Well, I think we should probably say the word romanticism. I mean, people will, I think, associate lots of the canonical romantic poets like Wordsworth and Coleridge and Shelley with the weather. My sort of image of Shelley is of an aerial, of something windborne. His Ode to the West Wind gives us that prompt. And we might think of the way that Wordsworth allows himself in his autobiography, The Prelude, to follow every wind that blows. He wants the weather to be his guide. And he wants big weather as well. He says in The Excursion, what a joy to roam an equal among mightiest energies. Now, that is really different, I think, from anything that we've met so far on this amazing tour.
Whirlwind tour.
But what I suppose the main thing I want to suggest here is that where before there's been a sense that you must keep the mightiness of the weather out or contend with it in battle, romanticism has this big new idea, which is that perhaps we might give ourselves, surrender ourselves to the mightiest energies of the weather.
Well, that comes into novels like the Brontes, doesn't it? Things like Wuthering Heights,
yes.
The Dangerous Outside.
Yes, so right. And why? Because the Brontes have been brought up on a generation of romantic writers who suggest this imaginative as well as physical power of the weather. I mean, there's that word we often use about art is inspiration. To inspire, to breathe into. And the Romantics take that quite literally. They think of the weather breathing a kind of creative energy into them. And in something like Wuthering Heights, Emily Bronte is absolutely taking that idea and looking at what Cathy does with it, a young woman of profound sense of connectedness with the mightiest energy she feels beyond her window, of terribly not wanting to be shut in, associating all her biggest emotions of love, of hate, of hope, with the weathers that she wants to run through and be part of and be as grand as. That's just what Wordsworth has suggested a little bit earlier in The Excursion. These writers are all reading each other and influencing each other. This is a long, magical conversation across centuries.
Of course, they didn't entirely agree with each other. Was it in Wetherland that I read, did you write that Charlotte Bronte didn't think much of Jane Austen's novels because there was no fresh air?
You're right. I do know. I've forgotten writing that.
It really made me laugh. It's all a bit too indoors, a bit too prim, indoors. Not enough wild weather.
I mean, you could argue against that in all sorts of ways, in that we could point to Austen and say, well, look, she's the one who sends Lizzie Bennet to get muddy on her way across country.
She does.
But then at the same time, as I think I've been saying throughout, there is some truth in broad brush caricatures and atmospheres. And isn't it also true that Austen is absolutely the writer who is interested in what happens indoors on a rainy day, how people get steamed up and fractious when they can't go out for their walk, and also how temperate weathers might allow a kind of rational thought. I mean, it's very striking in Sense and Sensibility that Marianne wants to be free and running out with the storm. She doesn't care about getting wet. Like a romantic poet, she wants to be out in the rain, and Eleanor is holding her back.
And Austin parodies all that in Northanger Abbey, yes, doesn't she? This whole sense of, you know, ridiculous teenage girls getting all caught up in gothic weather outside, and actually it's all nonsense.
This is it. It's as if Austin is saying throwing yourself into the weather is not the only way of appreciating it, of being conscious and intelligent in relation to nature. She does some beautiful, beautiful descriptions of just mild, temperate days, of flashes of sunlight, of characters who don't want to be too hot, who get headachy and worried in too much heat. Exactly as you're saying, she's very aware of the way that the Gothic novel is suggesting a caricature of stormy castle weather that will bring on dramatic love affairs and pull all the skeletons from the closets. And so, I suppose a bit like Shakespeare, she's so aware of archetypes.
And she subverts it, doesn't she, like him?
Yes.
When we were thinking about Austin, it just really made me think of, in Pride and Prejudice, like talking about the kind of sense of drama. But when Mrs. Bennet sends Jane out into the rain to catch a cold, so she'll then end up staying with Bingley, she's like, cast her out into this terrible, terrible weather, so she'll actually become very ill and then have to stay over, and then love will bloom. And, you know, Lizzie's fairly horrified despite being such an outdoorsy kind of person, but she's also seen as very transgressive for wanting to walk everywhere, because it's like, why on earth would you ever want to go out, like actually actively spend time outside? Yeah, make me think that Austin is taking that kind of trope and then just sending it up, really.
It's such a wonderful point. And it's true of both Austin and of Bronte that their characters do sometimes define themselves in terms of the weather that they most admire. And, you know, just as you're saying, Anna, to talk about one's outer ideas of weather is also to really tackle some complicated, entangled questions of inner sensibility and mood and influence as well.
If we move a bit further along in the 19th century and we think about people like Collins and Dickens and Hardy, I mean, would it be wrong of me to say that for me that's another damp era?
I think it would be right, actually.
Without wishing to be too broad brush about it.
I mean, I think we probably could identify some excellent weather in the Victorian period.
I'm sure we can.
But it's certainly the case that Wolfe introduces the onset of the 19th century with an enormous dark cloud and the sort of beautiful, cool, crisp, translucent Enlightenment weather of the 18th century descends into a sort of turmoil of roiling storms. And everything is very dark, and darkness, I think, really does have some triggers in the Victorian period. It's the time of maximum pollution. Everyone's still burning their coal fires. This is when we get the pea soupers. The huge, rapid industrialisation across the country meant that the way winter was experienced had a particular tone of grim grey, perhaps slightly yellowed smog in it. It was very difficult to keep anything clean. And so the material world, you know, our architecture, our buildings, our clothes, they all affect what we think about weather, the way we see it. And, you know, Dickens, his books are just weather epics.
Yes.
You know, I suppose Bleak House is the one from which we can unfurl the most foggy winter. I mean, it starts in November, fog everywhere. You know, the fog becomes the symbol of all that mental confusion that we get in the case of Jarndyce and Jarndyce. And it seems like there's just this whole society coughing and croaking and stifling itself and biting its cold fingers. And Esther Summerson is our only glint of summer sun. And Dickens, like so many of the great writers we've talked about, knows the stereotypes, knows them even as he's making them, and plays with them. You know, in his case, really pushing at this idea of obfuscation, of people getting in each other's way, fogging up, the right thing to do. I mean, he's a very socially concerned novelist. He can see with clarity some of the things that should be done in this society, and yet it's bound and clogged by this winter fog that we can't quite see through. And that mixture of romance and tiredness is so much there in the literature. I mean, you could make that the basis for reading Tennyson's In Memoriam. You could think about the way that elegies are constructed in relation to Victorian damp. Oh my goodness, if you started on Ruskin. perhaps we shouldn't, but Ruskin thought there was a whole new weather, terrible new kind of weather. He delivered a series of lectures called The Storm Cloud of the 19th Century. And I think people reading those now will be amazed at, again, how contemporary they sound. He thought that his weather was changing and that it was to do with a human misalliance with nature, that it was a punishment, and that there was a kind of cloud that wasn't a proper romantic cumulus nimbus cloud, but was just a blanket cloud that sat over the sun and blocked the light and made everybody's vegetables rot. That's Ruskin's horror of 19th century industrialization and, he thought, moral decline.
Incredibly prescient, wasn't he?
Very.
I mean, this almost brings us up to Virginia Woolf again, doesn't it? Her own time and the beginning of modernism.
Well, there was a real attempt to, I suppose, break through the damp. It's funny, writers really did understand the Victorian period as having been quite damp. And a writer like Wyndham Lewis, a very vigorous, rather pugilistic sort of writer who started a magazine called Blast and wanted to blast the English weather because he thought it was so nondescript that everybody was stuck, just as Dickens suggested they had been, and that what was needed was clear-sightedness. And he tried to make a kind of art and a kind of writing that was more definite. He thought people should be saying what they thought more, putting forward more extreme arguments in order to work out where they really stood, reclaiming some of that sort of drama, I suppose, that the Renaissance had dealt with. And what is intriguing is the level of self-consciousness. Auden is very, very good on modern cold. He thinks that winter is really a season for modern times because of the sort of discipline that it instills. And so he and Lewin McNeice wrote their letters from Iceland. Iceland was often where Auden really wanted to be. He wrote an essay called Why I Like It Cold, which has to do with, again, the kinds of concentration, of intellectual concentration that come from being indoors and reading, but also with a connection he felt right through the literature we're talking about. Artists and writers have responded differently to the same thing, which is landscapes that are reduced to their bareness somehow. Auden was drawn to the moors of northern England and the old mining towns, quite an austere landscape, and he's very drawn to the austerity of those places. Again, it's about the way that our tastes reflect our beliefs about the world, about what we're aiming for when we write.
I'm going to call time on this, Alex, because I think we have reached a neat destination just about the time of the First War, haven't we? Just the beginning of everything that came after, which I feel we could usefully talk about in another podcast, actually, because it's a whole different thing after that, isn't it? Well done. You did an absolutely cracking job of taking us right through.
Well, I'll pop in one more recommendation, which is if you want a sort of contemporary winter, Ali Smith's Winter from the Season Quartets picks up so much of what we've been talking about. There's Gawain and the Green Knight in there, there's Shakespeare, there's Dickens, and she suggests how we might find, you know, evergreen, new beginnings, new possibilities.
That's a great suggestion, actually. A great introduction. If people are interested to think about all the things we've been talking about, that would be a good place to start, wouldn't it?
It would. And you can go backwards from there as you can from all the great contemporary literature.
That was absolutely brilliant, Alex. Thank you so much. I've been writing notes as to things to read and things to investigate, which I'd, you know, not come across before. And I feel properly winterified, if that's a word.
Yes, it was absolutely wonderful, this sort of tour, and it kind of sparks one's imagination off.
Yes, I completely agree, especially when you were talking about Dickens. This time of year always makes me think of that article that Laura Freeman wrote for us, where she decided that she was going to read the entirety of Dickens in a year. And I always think that sounds like such an excellent notion at this time of year. Perhaps I shouldn't embark on Dickens, but maybe some of the other people you've mentioned in this podcast, actually.
Bravo, Alex. I didn't think we could do it, but you've done it. So congratulations. And as Gail says, I mean, there are many, many books mentioned there. But fear not, you will find them all in the show notes on whichever app you're using to listen, or indeed on the Fox website, where obviously you'll find a list of all the books and the authors that we mentioned. Foxquarterly.com is the web address. Gail, can I hear a dog snoring?
I'm afraid that's Chudley on the sofa. Yes, he's... He's now 11 and a half, and he's like a lot of old gentlemen. He has his morning snooze, and that's what he's doing at the moment.
I really like that image. Elegant, eclectic, and entertaining, Slightly Fox is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Now, this is the point at which normally we'd bring you recommendations from everyone around the table, but we've been chatting, and really, I think we've given you so many books to think about in that discussion with Alex. I think we're just going to give you just one this time. So I'm going to ask Gail what she's got for us.
I'm going to recommend a book that we've just reissued, Laurie Lee's Sided with Rosie, which, if you want an evocation of winter in the Cotswolds, that's the book to go to. It's a wonderful book, and his section on winter in particular is just glorious.
Thank you, Gail. Thanks again to everyone round the virtual table. A fantastic final episode for the year. We'll be back on January 15th. In the meantime, there is, as Anna said, still time to visit the Slightly Fox website for a spot of late Christmas shopping. Subscriptions to the quarterly magazine, perhaps, beautifully produced books, all sorts of other good things are there. If you'd like to rate the Fox podcast on whatever app you use to listen, we would be very grateful. And if you have time to write a review, many listeners have very kindly done this already, that would be the icing on our Christmas cake. And just before we leave you for 2020... many listeners have also told us this year that the podcast has been something of a bright spot each month during a difficult time, and we are so glad to hear that. And before we leave you, I know that Gail and Hazel have something they'd like to say too.
Yes, I think we both want to thank all our subscribers and listeners for having faith in us and for keeping us going this year. It's obviously been a difficult one, but it's had lots of silver linings, and probably the best of those has been the contact that we've had with you, wherever you are, wherever you're locked down. And here's hoping that next year is more cheerful. We've got lots of lovely things coming, so stick with us and keep smiling, I think.
Yes, I can only echo that. Our readers have been marvellous during this period, writing to us and helping us. And it seemed particularly important actually having these podcasts. So it's given us another way of sort of being in contact. And we'd just like to thank you very much and hope that next year is going to be brighter, which I think it certainly will. As Gail says, we've got a lot waiting for you.
Here's to 2021. Thanks for listening.